Are they gonna bail you out or just run you around? They said you should have a house the American way.
Well, hi folks, this is Jack Spirko with the Survival Podcast. Welcome to an episode of Friday Flashbacks. After 15 years and hundreds of interview shows, we decided to run them as flashbacks every Friday, beginning with the oldest of them and going forward. There's a tremendous library of wisdom in all the great interviews we've done over the years, so sit back and enjoy. Whether this is your first time or even your second time around with today's episode, I'm sure you will enjoy it and learn a lot from it. And remember, you can help support the Survival Podcast and the work we do just by becoming a member of the Survival Podcast Members Support Brigade. If you do that, you'll get access to over 70 awesome discount codes on products and services you likely already use. Things like seeds, cannabis products, food storage items, custom roasted coffee, and even cool stuff like ammo and moonshine stills and more. So support the show, get all your money back and more. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more and sign up. Now let's get into today's Friday Flashback. And today we rewind back to December the 1st, 2011, originally episode 794. This was Charles Kuntz on backup generators. Charles was an electrical engineer with about 10 years of on-the-job experience at the time of this episode, which is, again, more than a decade ago. But this is a great episode, and it's just as relevant today as it was all the way back in 2011 when we originally did it. And I love the way that this episode came out. Charles kept this very simple, very brass tacks, very much what you need to know about choosing a generator for your needs. And I'll just throw in with this that over the years, the number one prep that's paid off for us in our home here and up in Arkansas was the generator. Like more than anything else we did, the generator was the most valuable prep tool that we had. It's one that is sorely lacking in most households. And if you do not own a decent backup generator, you really should consider one. And this episode will help put you in the right direction in doing so. With that, let us go ahead and flashback December 1, 2011, originally episode 794. With that, I've got the housekeeping wrapped up, and I'm ready to introduce our special guest today. Our special guest again is Mr. Chad Kuntz. He is an electrical engineer for a large utility. He's been there for 10 years. He designs substations for generation facilities with backup power systems. So it's what he does for a living. He's here to talk to us about doing it in our own homes. Chad, welcome to the Survival Podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Hey, so, I mean, I'm really glad you reached out to us. This is like a really hot topic for TSP, and it's something that I have kind of limited knowledge with. I have a couple generators for the house. I've actually been looking for a whole house generator myself, so I am really excited about having you on today to help not just the listeners, but myself with some decisions I'm going to be making. But when we're looking at types of generators, how do we make that decision between, let's say, portable generators and whole house?
Well, I think it's a lot of personal preference. I know a lot of this information that I'm going to be have today is based on research that I've been doing for my own use and as well as what I've done in my professional life. I have a home on 1.5 acres, and I travel somewhat extensively for work, and I worry about my wife and future family being at home without possible heat or lights. So I've been trying to come up with a good solution myself. So I did a lot of research and used my professional engineering thinking and kind of came up with an outline here that we can talk about today.
Well, excellent. And I guess the first thing, and this has always been my big thing, is how do we size a generator, determine how much generator we need? Because I had a quote-unquote professional, who that's another word for salesman, come out and say, oh, yeah, you need a 20-kilowatt generator if you want a whole house generator, and I'm not quite so sure about that.
Well, I would have to agree. I don't think there's a whole lot of homes in North America that would actually require a 20 kW generator as a whole house backup source. I know one thing that I use in my personal mind is you have to balance between, do you want to live your life like there's nothing happening, or do you want to realize that their grid is down and you have to be a little conservative with your energy usage? So the first things I look at are the specific loads that you have in your house that are real important. I believe you have a well pump on your home there. That's a big one.
That's a huge one. That's one of my huge things, and it's not just about the draw, which I don't remember, but it's fairly significant. But it's also a critical system for me, because if I don't have the ability to run that, not only am I out of power, but I am out of water.
Right. So I look at well pump or water supply, and then heat and AC. And for myself, I live up here in the northern part of the U.S., and we get extremely cold, so the heat is more important for me. I know down in the south there, you guys think that AC is pretty important, and I guess I don't live in a place where it gets over 100 degrees for extended periods of time, so I don't feel that that's as important, but it can be. Sump pumps, another important one, or septic tank lift pumps. You know, just because you have water to flush the toilet, if you have a lift system in your septic tank, that's an important one too. Hot water heaters are also another one. So I kind of take those specific loads, and then you can also look at major appliances like your dryer, range, refrigerator, deep freeze, and microwave. Some of those could be considered convenient, such as your dryer or your microwave, but I think it would be important to at least include one or two elements of your stove and possibly your oven so that you could cook for yourself. Fridge and deep freezes are very important. You don't want your food to spoil. So I like to look at all those things that, and look at what their nameplate ratings are for the load in watts. And then, but many people would just add that up, and that may be where the salesman was coming from. If you add that up, of course it'll add up to probably 20 kilowatts or more. But
yeah, I mean, this is what I was looking at. I told you, I said, look, I don't need to be taking a hot shower, running nonstop, cooking on the range, cooking in the stove, have both of the refrigerator and the freezer on the kicked on draw, have the AC set on 65 degrees all at the same time. That just, it doesn't make sense to me that you would try to size it toward everything drawing full tilt at the same time.
Exactly. You hit the nail on the head. We call it load diversity. And I look at it, and I think I can take your total connected load and multiply that by probably 60 to 70%. And that can vary by personal preference, like I said, on what your budget is and what you feel you want and how many people are in the house. Because if it's just a couple that are living in the house, maybe your wife is doing some chores and you're doing some chores. But if there's children around, then there'll be more TVs, more entertainment, more lights possibly. So that can kind of up that percentage a little bit when you're looking at that thing.
Absolutely, and I mean, here's one of the things I thought of. We're going to, I guess, get into fuels here next, and so far it looks to me like I'm going to go with propane, and I'm going to have to bring in a big propane tank, and if I'm going to do that, it would be very easy, given that my home is a mobile home, and it's easy to access underneath to plumb in a few propane space heaters. So they're drawing from the propane that's already there, and that would be my supplemental heat, which is far more efficient than converting to electricity and then using the electric heat in a backup situation. So to me, that kind of helps out a lot as well.
Absolutely. There's no reason to go through two chemical energy conversions there to do that. You pulled right in there to the fuels. I've looked at propane myself. Personally, I have natural gas plumbed in my house. I have installed a propane generator in my professional career, and a few stumbling stones that I learned about is, you know, the great thing about propane is it's clean burning and it stores forever. So you have your tank out there, you can fill it up, and you don't have to worry about the fuel going bad. Bad things that I've come across or thought about with propane is it is a pressurized tank of explosive liquid. There is a bit of a hazard there. I don't feel it's a large hazard, but it is. And you can't readily go and fill the tank yourself to refuel or resupply where you could with a liquid fuel. So that's a couple downfalls of it. And also for any of your listeners in the northern climate here, one thing that I've learned when I installed it in my professional career is you don't burn liquid propane, you burn gaseous propane, and the propane actually boils within the tank and vaporizes to feed whatever appliance you're using. As the weather gets colder, that vaporization process happens at a slower rate, and you may need a larger tank just to supply enough vapor to your engine to run your generator.
That's really interesting. I did not know that. I'm kind of in a situation where if I'm going to go with
you know, gas, and I don't mean gasoline, but a gas, it's going to have to be propane because I don't have grid gas. So it's either propane, diesel, or gasoline for me.
Yep, and propane is a great option. I just want to make sure that you're aware of that. You can get fuel systems that actually draw liquid propane off the bottom of the storage tank, but then they have a vaporizer direct near the engine to provide enough vapor to feed that engine. And one thing to consider about propane, too, and this is just an FYI, is when I bought it, I realized that the engine on this propane generator was the same engine that it's an 8.1-liter GM V8 engine, and I thought, well, this is really derated for horsepower. And the salesman noted to me that propane has a lower energy density than gasoline. So if you're going to get a certain size generator, it may be a larger size engine than what you're expecting. And that's not really a downfall at all, but it was just something that shocked me at the time.
Yeah, I mean, because one of the things I've considered as a secondary option would be to go with diesel. You can store diesel for quite a while, and I have two diesel vehicles, so rotating the fuel wouldn't be a problem, and it's easier to bring in and out myself, and it would save the expense of a tank install and what have you. And there's other ways I can do backup heating and still save on the electrical draw. So I that's why I'm kind of still up in the air as what to do.
Yeah, personally, diesel is probably my for me, I'm going natural gas, I think, just because it is a grid-provided utility, and I don't feel that the risk of losing natural gas and electricity at the same time would be very great. I don't live in an earthquake zone. I think that's probably the major risk of natural gas source going down would be an earthquake. I don't live in a zone like that, so my personal choice will probably be propane, or natural gas, I'm sorry. But diesel is an excellent option because a lot of the engines can run at 1,800 RPM. With your diesel mechanic background, your maintenance isn't a problem for you. The life of the engine will be literally a lifetime. It's a lifetime investment that you could pass on to future generations or have as an asset with the home when you sell it. And as you said, if you have a couple diesel vehicles, you could put a couple 100-gallon storage tank on your home, and diesel is one thing that in any place you get far enough out, and it will be delivered to site, so you can have on-road or off-road diesel delivered to your home.
Yeah, and that was another thing I really didn't think of, but there's definitely a cost advantage there is I can run off for a diesel there. I can't then rotate it through my vehicles, at least I'm not supposed to, but that is a significant savings because you don't pay the taxes on it.
Exactly, yeah. And one thing is, you know, the fuel tank isn't much bulkier than propane. And one other thing that I wanted to bring up for the propane is also realize that when you buy a 500-gallon tank, you can't put 500 gallons of propane in there. I believe it's 80% fill capacity, so you only get 400 gallons of propane in that tank.
That's true, and it's another one of my big considerations that 500 gallons isn't 500 gallons. So then when you look at the capacity for running at, let's say, 50% load for the generator, you have to rate it at 80% of the runtime, not 100%, which is what my expert salesperson also did. So he said, look how long this will run. And he was kind of taken aback by that one. I don't think they really – the other thing was the guy wasn't very helpful with, you know, hey, can you recommend somebody to get the propane tank from and all? And I don't think they really handle that end very much. So I probably won't be using them no matter what I do.
Now, that's what I've run into, too, is the generator place usually does not have a lead on the propane. A fuel co-op or a fuel supply place would be the best place, and you can rent or purchase propane tanks. So.
Yeah, we were able to find it, but it just kind of bugged me that they didn't have any expertise there because that's kind of their – to me, that's kind of like a whole solution thing. I don't want to beat the guy up too much or anything, but that's just kind of how I felt. But so, I mean –
He probably wouldn't be plumbing the propane tank to the generator himself either. That would be another subcontractor.
Correct. So there was no total solution there. So what are your thoughts on gasoline?
Gas is just fine. You know, it has the same benefits really as diesel, as most people drive gasoline cars. So surge rotation is pretty easy. A couple of the bad things are is the fuel may not be available during a power outage, and it's kind of volatile and has a short shelf life. But if you can do that rotation through your vehicles, and again, you know, depending on where you live and what your local regulations and laws are, you maybe want to have a 100-gallon tank installed at your home, and you could fill up your cars and have that for your generator as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things I like about the diesel thing, and it would be the same for most people. Most people drive gasoline, that I have an additional reserve fuel capacity for either or, because you don't, I always say this to people, you don't get to pick your disaster. So all the people that go, well, when this happens, well, you don't know that's what's going to happen. All we know is that sooner or later, one system or another or multiple systems are going to fail.
Right. And I would say too, if I have a gas generator and a gas vehicle, I'm going to have 5W-30 oil on hand for maintenance and things like that. If I have a diesel generator and a diesel vehicle, I'll have 1540 on hand to do maintenance, and some similarities there. So, I think gas is a good option as well. I wanted to bring up one thing that kind of covers all the fuels is fuel tank sizing, and you brought it up a little bit. That's another personal preference there of how long do you think that you need to run this, especially if you do go with a propane or a gas or diesel of any fuel, how much should I have? And I know that that's a big topic on the forum, and you brought it up before too, and I think you really have to sit down and just say, how long of an incident am I going to plan for, and how do I think I can resupply myself and look at the size of generator? And again, that's where that salesman that's trying to push a 20 kW generator to you, that means your fuel tank is going to have to be very large to supply that with enough fuel to run for, say, a week. Whereas if you can trim down your energy usage to 10 kW, now I need half the fuel tank.
Correct. Or I can even go with a large fuel tank and support more like 2 to 3 weeks with some rationing, because I know darn well in my area that with an ice storm, I could be looking at 2 to 3 weeks without power, because guess what? It's happened before. And if it's happened before, it's possible that it will happen again. In fact, sometimes likely.
Right, and a lot of people will say, well, if I have the large generator, if I don't have it fully loaded, I won't use as much fuel. Yes, that's true, but it's similar to idling a V8 versus a four-cylinder car. Even idling, it will burn more fuel, and that's one thing to look at when you're sizing that fuel tank.
Yeah, and I think your number of 10K is closer to what I was actually kind of doing my own numbers, and I came to a conclusion of about 12 to 14K would be more than sufficient, and with a little bit of headroom. And the fuel utilization, even at half load or even at comparable loads, you're right, is definitely lower.
Yep.
So what about, like, looking at, like, you know, doing the, you know, like I'm looking at a fixed automatic on, backup generator, but also right now I'm using some portables. So, for instance, I've got a little bitty generator that, you know, pull start, and I pretty much use that as my keep one room cool air conditioner, where we have one of these little roll around AC units, and we close the room off, and we can keep the room cold in the winter. And I have a larger portable that I can hook up and run my well pump and a few other things with. But I'm not really in love with that, because it's kind of I've had nights where the power went off and we threw a couple logs on the fire and went, man, I really don't want to go out there and do this. So kind of making that choice, is it, if the budget's there, go ahead and do it, or are there ways that you can extend that, or, you know, what have you? Because I know that every time there's a disaster, I see people go out and buy generators, and most of these people don't even know what to do with them.
Right. I think if the budget allows, if you have probably around $3,000 to $4,000 to spend in your budget, I think a fixed auto transfer switch would be the best choice for some of the reasons that you said there. One thing, I think it's an asset to the home. There's less risk of theft as it's connected to your home and not just on wheels, if someone can throw it in the back of their pickup. And again, if it's bad weather or you're not around, how much capability does your significant other or family have? They don't have to worry about it with a fixed auto transfer switch. It's a 20-second wait. It comes on. When the grid comes back, it'll turn off. I think there's a lot of advantages there if the budget allows.
I agree. And, I mean, another thing is the fact that the power will come on when nobody's home means something to me, too. I had a time where my whole family was on vacation, and we had one of our deep freezers out in the garage in Texas, and it was about 110 degrees out, and when we came home, most, you know, the food in the, it was, you know, debatable whether it was bad or not, but I certainly wasn't going to risk it because it had been off for about 18 hours, and yeah, a freezer will hold cool for a while, but not in a hot garage, and everything was defrosted, and warm to the touch. And had I had a backup generator at the time, that just wouldn't have happened. So the cost right there, I mean, there was a bunch of deer meat in there. There was, you know, hundreds of dollars worth of meat lost. Well, you know, there's the generator paying for, you know, 10 or 20% of itself in one event.
Yeah, and some of the features, I've even done some research, and I'll just throw out a brand name. Cummins Onan is a pretty large, reputable generator supply. I mean, everyone knows Cummins diesel engines. They also do whole home generation systems, and they have a control panel that you actually put in the house, and it'll actually send out text or email alerts to you when the power does go out, and you have control over that through a website. So if you are on vacation and the power goes out and the generator starts, you can actually turn the generator off if you prefer, or you just know that an incident has happened and you might contact someone locally and say, hey, can you go over and check out my house and make sure everything is okay?
Yeah, it definitely beats my low-tech detection method that I used when we weren't living up here in Arkansas yet, and the house would be 3 months without us coming in, and I didn't know if, you know, the freezer could go off, the food could spoil, and then the freezer could refreeze, and we could come up here to use that food and then not know that it had done that. So my low-tech method, which I thought was actually kind of clever, is I came up with this. You get a 2-liter soda bottle, and then you fill it halfway with water, and you freeze it. And then you set it in your freezer upside down, and if it fully defrosts, the water will all be settled to the bottom of the, or, you know, which will now be the neck of the bottle instead of up top in the base. So that was like my only way to know if maybe the food had been contaminated. I figured if it didn't defrost, then the food was probably safe. Aside there, but it would have been much better to just have a generator kick on and take care of things.
That is a good kiss solution right there.
Yeah, I was kind of proud of it, actually. And it kind of happened by accident, the way that I found it. But we'll just keep going. You also have on your generator outline here, PTO portable. You want to talk a little bit about those?
Yeah, that was a while back. That was actually my preferred choice because I have a small 24-horse John Deere utility tractor that has a 540 RPM PTO shaft. And I could... You know, that I thought it was a great option. I said, yeah, I already have a power head that I already keep maintained. I know will start all the time. So I would just buy a small PTO generator. But I've come up with a couple detractions from that solution. Is number one is then my tractor is tied up, and I can't use it for moving snow or any other chores that I may want to do around the home. Second, I have to leave my tractor outside, which is somewhat of a danger with the spinning PTO shaft. A neighbor kid or somebody came by and didn't know the dangers of a spinning PTO shaft. And then third is my wife wouldn't be able to connect it up if I wasn't home. So that kind of took a lot of the pros away for me personally. But I think if you're on a large farm and you want a large generator around here, that was around this area, that was the end-all, be-all for a long time, was to have a PTO generator and just use one of your utility tractors. If you do have two tractors on a farm or something, it's a great solution.
Absolutely, and it saves you quite a bit of money.
It does, because you're not buying that other engine, and like I said, you're already maintaining the engine and know that it'll start and have a good battery and whatnot, so you don't have to worry about that. And that's one of the detractions against a small portable generator is you have to exercise these once in a while, and you have to make sure that the gas in the tank and the carburetor doesn't go bad. So you really should be running once a month. Well, that's just one more thing on your to-do list. With a fixed auto transfer switch, typically they have a battery charger connected that feeds off grid power and keep the battery charged. You'll have an exercise time that will do that every 30 days or so, and you can choose non-load exercising, or it will load up and exercise itself with plenty of your home load on. Exercises the generator as well as the engine.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things that the sales guy actually told me that I thought was really a great feature of the auto-on generators, where they'll basically power themselves up once a month and run load if you want them to for some period of time so that they stay in shape. And you don't have to remember to do that. Where with your, you know, you're right, with my portables, I go out and I start them. I have it on the calendar. I go out and I start them once a month, and I make sure that they're all working. And guess what? Every once in a while, one of them won't start, and I have to fiddle around with it and figure out why. So it's a big thing. On the portables, real quick, before we move on to kind of the connection types,
One thing I kind of glossed over was, what about carbon monoxide concerns with your portable generators? If we have a fixed generator sitting outside of the house, I'm not really worried about CO2. But if we have a portable generator, we can get into some trouble with those if we don't use them right.
That's correct. You know, the fixed one, obviously, it's going to have a muffler on it. It will have carbon monoxide emissions, but it's outside. You'll try to locate it away from a window or air intake for your furnace or whatnot. A lot of people get themselves in trouble because of some of the detractions that we've talked about for portable is, it sucks to go out in the middle of a thunderstorm and try to get a portable generator running in the rain. So they'll run them in their garage or nearby a house or a door or a window, and then you're pulling in all those nasty fumes from that internal combustion engine into your house, and it's called the silent killer because people go to bed and they don't wake up, and you don't want to have a strategy like that happen to your family just because you were trying to provide for them during an emergency.
Yeah,
that definitely is a concern. So I would, and moving over to connections a little bit, definitely make sure you get a long enough cord so you can get that away from the windows and air intakes, and, you're going to have to be outside. That's your choice.
Yeah, and I mean, with the cord stuff, moving on to that, I mean, it's important to look at the size of your cords, too, because, and I think a lot of people do this not just with generators, but other pieces of equipment running at long distances, they put too thin of a gauge extension cord on there. It's not like running some Christmas lights where just any old thing will do.
Right. Many people aren't even aware of what gauge of wire is in the extension cords. They go to the hardware store and they look for the least expensive, most economical cord they can, and a lot of times that can be a 16 gauge or 18 gauge extension cord. I fully believe that if you invest in a good high quality 12 gauge extension cord that has a good jacket on it that stays flexible in the wintertime, I know I've used, it's called Frog Hide, and it's a Carroll product. I believe Carroll is the manufacturer of it. They're expensive, but it's the best extension cord I've ever bought. I actually bought it in college when I had no money, and it's lasted 15 years. It'll probably last another 15 more. They stay flexible in probably minus 30 degree weather, and it's got a heavy enough gauge that you can actually run the appliances safely and not have to worry about overheating.
Yeah, there's three things that I would say that you should never buy the cheap version thereof. One, power tools. Two, garden hoses. Three, extension cords. They always end up costing you more when you go the cheap route with those three things. And extension cords, thin gauge cords, can actually be a fire hazard.
They can. And also, if you have too thin of a cord, you'll have too large of a voltage drop to start maybe a large well pump or a sump pump. So that's another consideration. I did a little exercise preparing for the interview here, and I think a great thing to do if you did go with a portable generator is to make up your own portable power distribution center. I went online at Lowe's, and I found a 100-amp square D panel for $23. You could buy six breakers, six 20-amp receptacles and boxes, connect all that up with some scrap wire, screw it to a piece of scrap plywood. For about $120, you could have a power distribution center that you want to run one large gauge cord into your home, and then your generator can still be at a safe enough distance for carbon monoxide, and then all those cords, you don't have a spaghetti mess of cords running in through a door somewhere.
Yeah, definitely. And that's something else I've also seen people do is, okay, I got a generator and there's two outlets on it, so I'll get a power strip and stick it in one of those, and then they have extension cords going everywhere and some of the stuff doesn't work. And then they're surprised. Like, I mean, I remember one of my buddies had one of these real little generators, I think it was like a 1K, and he had a couple lights going and everything was fine until he tried to run a coffee maker. And a coffee maker shut it down. It just didn't have the power to run a coffee maker, and I think it's because it's heat.
Yeah, they have large heating elements in them. You don't realize what kind of appliance that is there.
Absolutely. So let's look at where you're talking about cords and manual transfer switches, because I think if you're going with most of the portables, that's kind of what you're going to be with. You're going to have to switch power over, and that's something that basically all I've done is just run as needed with my portables up till now. I've never wired my generators into the house's distribution system. So how do we kind of go about that?
Well, I think the the cord to manual transfer switch is the next step up. If you're going to use portable, I think it's a better connection to your home. You can buy a whole house transfer switch for probably about $350 to $500. A 100-amp service entrance transfer switch is $400. So then you could connect that up, and that will go right out by the meter for your electrical service, with the electrical service on one side and a plug where you would plug in that heavy gauge cable from your portable generator with a switch that you would have to throw manually when you were using the generator. And what that does is it disconnects your home from the grid to protect utility workers while you're running off your generator, but it all, in concert, it connects your entire home's panel, surface panel, to your generator. So all of your loads throughout your home are already connected, and you just have to use your breakers to turn loads on and off so as not to overload the generator.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And are there any other major considerations we need to take into account when using a portable with a transfer switch?
Not really. The transfer switch is really the main safety mechanism. It's going to break the grid connection before it connects to the generator. So you just start up your portable generator, and once that's running and the voltmeter and the frequency meter on the generator says everything is okay, go ahead and throw that switch. It's called a break before make. It'll break the utility connection and make the generator connection, and your panel will be connected. I guess the one thing that I would probably do is turn off all the breakers in the home first so as not to overload that generator and trip it off right away, and then just slowly add load on until you either get to the point where you're comfortable in the home or that the generator is overloaded and you can no longer add any load.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. What about if we want to move to kind of an auto transfer switch? Is there some of that stuff that can be done by kind of the do-it-yourselfer, or is that where we go to definitely needing an electrician?
Well, I don't want to say that this is true in all localities. I know it changes between city, county, municipalities. I think if you go with the auto transfer switch that has a limited number of circuits, I think that's a do-it-yourselfer thing. If you're somewhat familiar with electrical, some licensed electricians may get upset with me with that. But there are some things that do-it-yourselfers can do as long as it's done in a safe manner. A lot of these, you take a large 100-amp breaker from your main panel and feed this quote-unquote sub-panel with that breaker, and then you just wire nut the supplied pigtails from that panel to the wires going out to the loads and abandon the breakers that are in your panel to begin with. I think that's a do-it-yourselfer thing. There's no connections directly to the service from the utility. But if you're not comfortable with that, by all means, hire a licensed electrician. It'll be done properly, and you'll know it'll work. That's the first option with a auto transfer switch, is only to have what you would consider critical loads connected. And some of these transfer switches have 10 circuits, 12 circuits, all the way up to probably 18, 16 circuits, I think, might be the maximum. So if you look at your home panel, you probably have, depending on the size of your home, anywhere between 20 and 30 circuits. So you'll only be able to put about half of those on the generator itself.
That makes sense, and I think that's an area where you can start to, just by, even if you're not going to do this, even if you're going to go to something that's more of a whole house and you're sizing out what your needs are, if you just sit there and look at that panel and start saying, nice to have, gotta have, don't need, that can start to help you a lot with your sizing requirements.
Yeah, the one downfall is depending on if you built the house and the electrician was a good common sense electrician, or maybe you had an apprentice working on that particular job, sometimes the breaker circuits just don't have a rhyme or reason, or what you want is going to be on the circuit that also has something different and you won't be able to change it. So you'd have to just control the loading based on the appliances or the lighting that you use.
Yeah, that makes sense as well. But if we're going to step up though now and move into a whole house, that's where I need to be calling the licensed electrician in.
Yeah, if you're going to do a service entrance auto transfer switch, which I think is the best bang for the buck, I looked up that, and some of these service entrance transfer switches are about the same cost as what limited circuits are. And then you don't have to have a subpanel. Why repurchase that asset when you already have it in your home and you could just put a whole house service entrance transfer switch? And there you're going to need a licensed electrician, because most utilities won't turn off the energy to the meter for a do-it-yourselfer. So, and also you're dealing with higher current, probably more things that the average do-it-yourselfer wouldn't be familiar with. So I think a licensed electrician for a project of that type would be a good idea.
And then from my experience, like looking with like Generac and some other companies, when you get into that level of installation, I think even if you could get away with doing it yourself, you need it for some of the warranty issues.
Possibly. I've heard some of these companies, I don't even know if they would warranty something like that. I think a lot of them, I know I can go down to my local Menards and buy a Generac with a limited circuit auto transfer switch. So I don't know if I've never read the fine print on warranty issues, but I think they're marketed as a do-it-yourself project.
Okay, so maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe that's more misinformation from my certified installer there. Who knows? But when we look at a whole house transfer switch, we need some things you said we need to make sure we do. And one is make sure they're properly sized, and I guess we need to look at cost as well.
Right. Most houses have several different service sizes. Probably 100, 150, and 200-amp services are most common in the area where I live. I don't know if that holds true throughout the country, but it's pretty easy to find if you just go down to your main service panel and look at what the main breaker size is. If it says 100, well, then it doesn't pay for you to go and buy a 200-amp transfer switch. But if you have a 200-amp panel, you probably want to size the transfer switch as large as the panel so that you're not limiting yourself anywhere. You don't want one component to limit another component's capability.
And what are we looking at for cost for something like this?
Well, I did a little research on the web, and I found a service entrance transfer switch at 100 amp for around $400. A 200 amp, you're probably $600 to $700. The cost is not linear. You may find a little better price here or there. So it is a significant investment. But like I said, I think it's the best bang for the buck. You have the whole house if you size the generator properly. Going about your day-to-day lives, you don't have to worry of, oh, there's no lights in this room because it wasn't on a critical circuit, but there is in this room.
I mean, I always look at things like someday I may sell my house. And if I have like a portable generator and I've done all this wiring in myself and you can hook it up, and I want to sell the generator with the house, and I tell the new homeowner, look, this is what you do. You pull it out. Start it up, you plug this in here, you throw the switch. That's all complicated to the new homeowner. If you tell the new homeowner, look, if the power goes off, it's going to turn on and run, put fuel in here, done. It's a big upselling point to the house.
I think so. I think this is becoming not just a prepper issue. I think it's becoming more and more of a mainstream thing that people are looking at this after ice storms, blizzards, hurricanes. They're looking and seeing that electricity is becoming a mainstay of their lives. And they need some sort of backup energy source.
So another thing we can look at then is there's really two types of generators, at least from your outline here. And you call the first one an inverter. And you say they're mainly on the portable generator. So what are we looking at when we look at an inverter type generator?
Well, really you're looking at the small Hondas. Yamaha makes them. Pretty much all the cheap Chinese brands will also make them too. You're looking at a generator probably of 3,000 watts or less. And what that is power electronics has come down in cost so much that they can put an inverter on the output of that generator, change the AC output, variable voltage and variable frequency, to DC, and then convert that to straight 120-volt, 60-hertz sine wave like you would use on all your appliances in your home. And the great upside of that is now that small engine doesn't have to run at a fixed RPM, so they can slow the governor down and save fuel. That's why people love their little 2,000-watt Honda generators. They weigh 40 pounds, and they run on a gallon of gasoline for a day. You know, it's a great, great thing, but it'll be on a smaller generator.
Yeah, and they're really quiet, too, those little Hondas.
they are. They're a wonderful little machine. Personally, I think you have it right, do a whole house, and if I could have a couple 2,000-watt Hondas, if money was no object, they're great for camping and tailgating and any other event that you may want to.
Absolutely, and then there's always the old 2 is 1 and 1 is none thing. So at least you got something if your larger system even runs out of fuel. Let's say you have a diesel or a propane or natural gas major backup system, and you go into a prolonged situation and you do use up all of your system, or the system breaks down. If you have a couple portables, you still have something.
Yep, and people don't. I know Hondas and the Yamahas are very expensive, but I think that there again, it's a long-term investment. I'd hate to, you know, I have some people that I'm friends with that feel $250, everybody should have one. If it dies out in 2 years, that's great. You know, I can't argue with that logic too much, but I know that the Honda and Yamaha are going to be quieter, and I know that I have a service department at the local dealership that will stand behind them real well, too.
Yeah, I mean, I look at those and I say they cost like 2 to 3 times as much, and they're worth it. And so as long as you got the funds, I think they're the way to go. But then again, if you can pick up a little, you know, 1,500-watt, 2,000-watt generator from Sportsman's Guide for $129, it's better than nothing.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. One thing about the inverter, some people may be concerned about harmonics. Since it is most likely a pulse width modulated sine wave, there are going to be some harmonics there. However, if you're running a fridge or a well pump or something like that, induction motors tend to smooth out the current and don't care about that too much. When you're not doing a variable frequency drive, when it's just an inverter like that, most of the time your induction motors will just cruise along just fine, not have a care in the world. And then electronics, that's the next biggest concern for people. And I myself, I don't have that concern with that. Maybe after this show air, someone can correct me if I'm wrong. I know I wasn't the greatest in electronics in school, but you know, most computers and TVs and other appliances, they have a switch mode power supply that changes it down to 5 or 10 volts DC anyway. So that's going to clean up any harmonics. Those harmonics are not going to get into your sensitive electronics in the first place.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that from all the research I've done up till now. And I have to say, I've used a portable generator to run things like, you know, a refrigerator or a freezer, and I haven't had any problems.
Yeah. And then we keep going down here. My second item is just the standard generator head. That's going to be your induction machine that's excited, provides a sine wave based on the input speed of the prime mover and voltage based on the excitation of the machine. Two things you want to keep in mind there is the best generators will have an automatic voltage regulator. What that does is it's a closed feedback loop, and it's going to measure the output voltage and try to keep it at your nominal 120, 240 volts so that you don't have spikes and dips in your voltage as your generator is running and as you add load and subtract load. And the second thing, I guess, is really important for PTO generators, probably not as much so as other combined prime mover generators, is there's typically a frequency gauge on the generator as well. And here's where these generators are at a disadvantage with inverters, is you need to keep the speed such that the frequency of the output is at 60 hertz. If you start trying to save fuel by running a tractor, especially a PTO generator, or modify the governor on a portable to run at a slower speed, now you're going to run the risk of burning out your induction motors in your fridge, pumps, anything like that.
Yeah, I guess I never really thought about that. It seems like you'd have to know what you were doing to do it with a portable, but it seems pretty easy to just run your PTO a little slower and think that's gonna help things, but apparently not really a good idea.
No, it's not. My father is actually a line superintendent for another local co-op, and a farmer did that. Someone told him, oh, if you're worried about the fuel costs, save fuel, slow your tractor down. Yeah, he did that, and he burned out every fridge, freezer, well pump, irrigation pump that he had on his farm. It's not a good thing.
Okay, great. So I guess our big ones then we're worried about with stuff like that are fridge, freezer, and well pump from your outline. But
the whole overall writing message is just don't do it anyway.
Right. It's not, I mean, it's going to make your lights dim. It's going to, any electric heat that you have, it won't be putting out as much heat, and it's just not going to be good for most things. So best to just plan for your fuel consumption, running it at proper frequency.
Okay, and then you have the last thing you have here is we want to make sure we get a unit with an automatic voltage regulator.
Yeah, I kind of mentioned that earlier. That just means that it's going to regulate the voltage as you add or subtract load. As you add load, typically voltage will start dropping, so the generator will add more excitation current to the machine. No input from the user needed. It's just going to measure its output voltage, and as it starts dropping lower, it will try to raise that voltage to the nominal set at the factory.
Great. And you've got some references here for folks?
As I was doing my research to come up with this information, because I had a lot of this in my head, but I felt I'd better do a good job for your audience, as most interviewees do, GeneratorJoe.net has a lot of great information. They have a fuel comparison guide there and a lot of great information on that. Most of the prices that I came up with to purchase transfer switches or cords or even both portable and whole house generators, electricgeneratorsdirect.com, seems like I can't say anything about the service. I've never purchased anything from them, but boy, the prices are darn reasonable. And then one company that I like, basically because I worked with them in my professional career, is Cummins Onan. I have a great local sales rep, and they do have a residential website. If you just do a search for CumminsOnan.com /residential, there's a sizing calculator there, a lot of information on their control panels, how to maintain a generator, a lot of great information there too.
Well, man, I appreciate all the effort you put into this, Chad. Thank you so much. It's been a great interview, and I'll make sure I put links to those three references in today's show notes. I'd also imagine that folks may have some questions for you, and they'll probably comment in the blog, and I'm sure you'd be happy to maybe check in with those after the show's been up for a day or two and maybe give us some answers on the stuff that I didn't think of to ask you.
Absolutely. You know, I'll look at the comment section. I don't know when the show is going to air, but I listen every day, so I'll make sure to check out the comment section. And if anybody wants to contact me after the comments, maybe we'll get together and have a little email string. And I'm more than happy to help people out as long as it doesn't infringe on my personal life too much. I don't want to make my life mad at me.
Yeah, you always got to qualify that. And the show is going to actually air on Thursday of this week. It'll be the 1st of December. So you're going to be kicking off the month of December.
Cool.
Well, folks, with that, I mean, this has been great. Again, Chad, thank you so much. You've helped me clarify some things. I think I'd pretty much gotten to a conclusion with my own needs here for a standby unit, and I think you've really reinforced those and helped me figure out I'm on the right track. I'm sure you've done that for others. I'm sure that there's also some people out there who are thinking, now I have a better understanding of this, and it doesn't seem so over my head. I know that when I first started trying to figure this out, yeah, I was like, man, some of these areas, I just don't really know what I need to do. So I think maybe you save a lot of other folks that heartache. So, again, thanks for being on the show today.
You're welcome, and I'll throw it out that I will help you with any questions you have when dealing with those slimy salesmen at your home.
I just think that guy's not coming back. But, again, thank you, and I appreciate that. And as I get closer to making a final decision, I'll run some things by you. So thanks again. And with that, folks, today this has been Jack Spirico along with Chad Kuntz, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough, or even if they don't. Well, thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Survival Podcast Friday Flashbacks. If you enjoyed today's show, please consider becoming an MSB member. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more. You can also support our show by going to TSPAZ, that's T-S-P-A-Z, TSPAZ.com. Anytime you shop online, and while you'll support us no matter what you buy, you will find over 500 reviews of items I have personally tested and vouched for. And to stay in touch with us and never miss anything, follow our channel or our group on Telegram. You can find links to that and all our social media options. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and check the show notes for any episode.